These are not measures fit for wise rulers. The state salt monopoly disappeared for 600 years. But it was resurrected. During the Tang Dynasty, which lasted from 618 to 907, half the revenue of the Chinese state was derived from salt. Aristocrats showed off their salt wealth by the unusual extravagance of serving pure salt at the dinner table, something rarely done in China, and placing it in a lavish, ornate salt cellar. Over the centuries, many popular uprisings bitterly protested the salt monopoly, including an angry mob that took over the city of Xi'an, just north of Sichuan, in 880. And the other great moral and political questions of the great debate on salt and iron, the need for profits, the rights and obligations of nobility, aid to the poor, the importance of a balanced budget, the appropriate tax burden, the risk of anarchy, and the dividing line between rule of law and tyranny, have all remained unresolved issues. Chapter 2. Fish, Fowls, and Pharaohs. On the eastern end of North Africa's almost unimaginably vast desert, the Nile River provides a fertile green passage only a few miles wide down both banks. Egyptian civilization has always been crammed into this narrow strip, surrounded by a crawling, wind-swept desert like a lapping sea that threatens to wash it away. Even today in modern high-rise Cairo, the sweepers come out in the morning to chase away the sand from the devouring desert. The earliest Egyptian burial sites have been found where the desert begins at the edge of the green strip on either side. They date from about 3000 BC, the same time as the earliest record of salt-making in Sichuan. But before the era of the great Egyptian states, and even before such marks of Egyptian civilization as hieroglyphics, the cadavers at these early burial sites still have flesh and skin. They are not mummies, and yet are surprisingly well-preserved for 5,000-year-old corpses. The dry, salty desert sand protected them, and this natural desert phenomenon held the rudiments of an idea about preserving flesh. To the Egyptians, a dead body was the vessel connecting earthly life to the afterlife. Eternal life could be maintained by a sculpted image of the person, or even by the repetition of the deceased's name. But the ideal circumstance was to have the body permanently preserved. At all stages of ancient Egyptian civilization, a tomb had two parts, one below ground for housing the corpse, and a second area above for offerings. In simpler burial places, the upper part might be just the open area above ground. The upper level makes clear the importance the ancient Egyptians attached to the preparation and eating of food. Elaborate funereal feasts were held in these spaces, and copious quantities of food were left as offerings. The feasts, and sometimes the preparation of foods, were depicted on the walls. Every important period in ancient Egyptian history produced tombs containing detailed information about food. Though the intention was to leave this for the benefit of the deceased, it has given posterity a clear view of an elaborate and inventive ancient cuisine. The poorest may have had little to eat but unraised bread, beer, and onions. The Egyptians credited onions and garlic with great medicinal qualities, believing that onion layers resembled the concentric circles of the universe. Onions were placed in the mummified cadavers of the dead, sometimes serving in place of the eyes. Herodotus, the Greek historian born about 490 BC and considered the founder of the modern discipline of history, described the tomb of the Pyramid of Giza, built about 2900 BC. He wrote that an inscription on one wall asserted that during 20 years of construction, the builders supplied the workers with radishes, onions, and garlic worth 1,600 talents of silver, which in contemporary dollars would be about 2 million. But the upper classes had a richly varied diet, perhaps the most evolved cuisine of their time. Remains of food found in a tomb from before 2000 BC include quail, stewed pigeon, fish, ribs of beef, kidneys, barley porridge, wheat bread, stewed figs, berries, cheese, wine, and beer. Other funereal offerings found in tombs included salted fish and a wooden container holding table salt. The Egyptians mixed brine with vinegar and used it as a sauce known as oxalm, which was later used by the Romans. Like the Sichuan Chinese, the Egyptians had an appreciation for vegetables preserved in brine or salt. "There is no better food than salted vegetables," are words written on an ancient papyrus. Also, they made a condiment from preserved fish or fish entrails in brine, perhaps similar to the Chinese forerunner of soy sauce. The ancient Egyptians may have been the first to cure meat and fish with salt. The earliest Chinese record of preserving fish in salt dates from around 2000 BC. Salted fish and birds have been found in Egyptian tombs from considerably earlier. Curing flesh in salt absorbs the moisture in which bacteria grows. Furthermore, the salt itself kills bacteria. Some of the impurities found in ancient sodium chloride were other salts, such as saltpeter, which are even more aggressive bacteria slayers. Proteins unwind when exposed to heat, and they do the same when exposed to salt. So, salting has an effect resembling cooking. Whether the Egyptians discovered this process first or not, they were certainly the first civilization to preserve food on a large scale. Those narrow, fertile strips on either bank of the Nile were their principal source of food, and a dry year in which the Nile failed to flood could be disastrous. To be prepared, Egyptians put up food in every way they could, including stockpiling grain in huge silos. This fixation on preserving a food supply led to considerable knowledge of curing and fermentation. Were it not for their aversion to pigs, the Egyptians would probably have invented ham, for they salt-cured meat and knew how to domesticate the pig. But Egyptian religious leadership pronounced pigs carriers of leprosy, made pig farmers social outcasts, and never depicted the animal on the walls of tombs. They tried to domesticate for meat the hyenas that scavenged the edge of villages looking for scraps and dead animals to eat, but most Egyptians were revolted by the idea of eating such an animal. Other failed Egyptian attempts at animal husbandry include antelope, gazelle, oryx, and ibex. In the northern Sinai and what is now the southern Israeli Negev Desert, the remnants of pens for such fauna, the remains of these failed experiments, have been found. But the Egyptians did succeed in domesticating fowl: ducks, geese, quail, pigeon, and pelican. Ancient walls show fowl being splayed, salted, and put into large earthen jars. A great source of Egyptian food was the wetlands of the Nile, the reedy marshes where fowl could be found, as well as fish such as carp, eel, mullet, perch, and tigerfish. The Egyptians salted much of this fish. They also dried, salted, and pressed the eggs of mullet, creating another of the great Mediterranean foods known in Italian as botarga. The Egyptians lay claim to another pivotal food invention, making the fruit of the olive tree edible. Almost every Mediterranean culture claims olives as its discovery. The Egyptians of 4000 BC believed that the goddess Isis, wife of Osiris, taught them how to grow olives. The Greeks have a similar legend. But the Hebrew word for olive, zeit, is probably older than the Greek word elaia and is thought to refer to sade in the Nile Delta. It may have been Syrians or Cretans who first bred the Olea europaea from the pathetic, scraggly, wild oleaster tree. The Egyptians were not great olive oil producers and imported most of their olive oil from the Middle East. The fresh-picked fruit of the olive tree is so hard and bitter, so unappealing, that it is a wonder anyone experimented long enough to find a way to make it edible. But the Egyptians learned very early that the bitter glucides unique to this fruit, now known as oleuropeana, could be removed from the fruit by soaking in water, and the fruit could be softened in brine. The salt would render it not only edible, but enjoyable. Making olives and making olive oil are at cross purposes, since a good eating olive is low in oil content. It may be that this was characteristic of Egyptian olives. These eating olives were included in the food caches of ancient Egyptian tombs. The Egyptians were the inventors of raised bread. To make leavened bread, a gluten-producing grain, not barley or millet, was necessary. And about 3000 BC, the Egyptians developed wheat that could be ground and stretched into a dough capable of entrapping carbon dioxide from yeast. The starting yeast was often leftover fermented dough, sourdough, which is another example of lactic acid fermentation. Egyptian bakers created an enormous variety of breads in different shapes, sometimes with the addition of honey or milk or eggs. Most of these doughs, as with modern breads, were made from a base of flour, water, and a pinch of salt. In 1250 BC, when Moses liberated the Hebrew slaves, leading them out of Egypt across the Sinai, the Hebrews took with them only flat, unleavened bread, matzo, which is described by the Hebrew phrase lechem oni, meaning bread of the poor. Poor Egyptians did not have the sumptuous assortment of Egyptian-raised bread, but, like people outside of Egypt, ate flat bread known as ta, which sometimes had coarse grain, even chaff, in it, and lacked the luxury of a pinch of salt. According to Jewish legend, the fleeing Hebrews took unleavened bread because they lacked time to let the bread rise. But it may also have been what they were used to making, or perhaps it was a conscious rejection of Egyptian culture and the luxuries of the slave owners. Raised bread and salt curing were emblematic of the high living Egyptians. The Egyptians made salt by evaporating seawater in the Nile Delta. They also may have procured some salt from Mediterranean trade. They clearly obtained salt from African trade, especially from Libya and Ethiopia. But they also had their own desert of dried salt lakes and salt deposits. It is known that they had a number of varieties of salt, including a table salt called Northern Salt, and another called Red Salt, which may have come from a lake near Memphis. Long before 17th and 18th century chemists began identifying and naming the elements of different salts, ancient alchemists, healers, and cooks were aware that different salts existed, with different tastes and chemical properties that made them suitable for different tasks. The Chinese had invented gunpowder by isolating saltpeter, potassium nitrate. The Egyptians found a salt that, though they could not have expressed it in these terms, is a mixture of sodium bicarbonate and sodium carbonate with a small amount of sodium chloride. They found this salt in nature in a wadi, an Arab word for a dry riverbed, some 40 miles northwest of Cairo. The spot was called Natron, and they named the salt Nedri, or Natron, after the wadi. Natron is found in white and red, though white natron is usually gray and red natron is pink. The ancient Egyptians referred to natron as the divine salt. The culminating ritual of the lengthy Egyptian funeral was known as the opening of the mouth, in which a symbolic cutting of the umbilical cord freed the corpse to eat in the afterlife, just as cutting a newborn baby's cord is the prelude to its taking earthly nourishment. In 1352 BC, the child pharaoh Tutankhamun died at the age of 18, and his tomb, discovered in 1922, is the most elaborate and well-preserved ever found. The tomb was furnished with a bronze knife for the symbolic cutting of the cord, surrounded by four shrines, each containing cups filled with the two vital ingredients for preserving mummies, resin and natron. Investigators argue about whether sodium chloride was used in mummification. It is difficult to know, since natron contains a small amount of sodium chloride that leaves traces of common salt in all mummies. Sodium chloride appears to have been used instead of natron in some burials of less affluent people. Herodotus, though writing more than 2 millennia after the practice began, offered a description in gruesome detail of ancient Egyptian mummification, which, with a few exceptions, such as his confusion of juniper oil for cedar oil, has stood up to the examination and chemical analysis of modern archaeology. The techniques bear remarkable similarity to the Egyptian practice of preserving birds and fish through disembowelment and salting. The most perfect process is as follows. As much as possible of the brain is removed via the nostrils with an iron hook, and what cannot be reached with the hook is washed out with drugs. Next, the flank is opened with a flint knife, and the whole contents of the abdomen removed. The cavity is then thoroughly cleaned and washed out, firstly with palm wine and again with an infusion of ground spices. After that, it is filled with pure myrrh, cassia, and every other aromatic substance, excepting frankincense, and sewn up again, after which the body is placed in natron, covered entirely over for 70 days, never longer. When this period is over, the body is washed and then wrapped from head to foot in linen cut into strips and smeared on the underside with gum, which is commonly used by the Egyptians instead of glue. In this condition, the body is given back to the family, who have a wooden case made, shaped like a human figure, into which it is put. He then gave a less expensive method, and finally, the discount technique. The third method, used for embalming the bodies of the poor, is simply to wash out the intestines and keep the body for 70 days in natron. The parallels between preserving food and preserving mummies were apparently not lost on posterity. In the 19th century, when mummies from Saqqara and Thebes were taken from tombs and brought to Cairo, they were taxed as salted fish before being permitted entry to the city. More than a gastronomic development, the salting of fowl, and especially of fish, was an important step in the development of economies. In the ancient world, the Egyptians were leading exporters of raw foods, such as wheat and lentils. Although salt was a valuable commodity for trade, it was bulky. By making a product with the salt, a value was added per pound, and unlike fresh food, salt fish, well handled, would not spoil. The Egyptians did not export great quantities of salt, but exported considerable amounts of salted food, especially fish, to the Middle East. Trade in salted food would shape economies for the next 4 millennia. About 2800 BC, the Egyptians began trading salt fish for Phoenician cedar, glass, and purple dye made from seashells by a secret Phoenician formula. The Phoenicians had built a trade empire with these products, but in time, they also traded the products of their partners, such as Egyptian saltfish and North African salt, throughout the Mediterranean. Originally inhabiting a narrow strip of land on the Lebanese coast north of Mount Carmel, the Phoenicians were a mixture of races, only partly Semitic. They never fused into a homogeneous nation. Culturally, other people, first the Egyptians and later the Greeks, dominated their way of life. But economically, they were a leading power operating from major ports such as Tyre. They traded with everyone they encountered. When Solomon constructed a temple in Jerusalem, the Phoenicians provided both wood, their famous cedars of Lebanon, and craftsmen. In the Old Testament, it is mentioned that Jerusalem fish markets were supplied from Tyre, and the fish they sold was probably salted fish, since fresh fish would have spoiled before reaching Jerusalem. It is a Mediterranean habit to credit good food ideas to the Phoenicians. They are said to have spread the olive tree throughout the Mediterranean. The Spanish say the Phoenicians introduced chickpeas, a Western Asian bean, to the Western Mediterranean, though evidence of wild native chickpeas has been found in the Catalan part of southern France. Some French writers have said the Phoenicians invented bouillabaisse, which is probably not true, and the Sicilians say the Phoenicians were the first to catch bluefin tuna off their western coast, which probably is true. The Phoenicians also established the salt works on the western side of the island of Sicily, near present-day Trapani, to cure the catch. Ancient Phoenician coins with images of the tuna have been found near a number of Mediterranean ports. At the time, bluefin tuna, the swift, steel-blue-backed fish that is the largest member of the tuna family, might have attained sizes of over 1,500 pounds each. But this is according to ancient writers who also believed the fish fed on acorns. Seeking warmer water for spawning, bluefin leave the Atlantic Ocean near the Strait of Gibraltar, pass by North Africa and western Sicily, cruise past Greece, swim through the Bosporus and into the Black Sea. At all the points of land near the bluefin's passage in the Mediterranean, the Phoenicians established tuna fisheries. About 800 BC, when the Phoenicians first settled on the coast of what is today Tunisia, they founded a seaport, Sfax, which still prospers today. Sfax became and has remained a source of salt and salted fish for Mediterranean trade. The Phoenicians also founded Cadiz in southern Spain, from where they exported tin. Almost 2,500 years before the Portuguese mariners explored West Africa, the Phoenicians sailed from Cadiz through the Strait of Gibraltar and on to the West African coast. The Phoenicians are also credited with the first alphabet. Chinese and Egyptian languages used pictographs, drawings depicting objects or concepts. Babylonian, which became the international language in the Middle East, also had a long list of characters, each standing for a word or combination of sounds. But the Phoenicians used a Semitic forerunner of ancient Hebrew, the earliest traces of which were found in the Sinai from 1400 BC, which had only 22 characters, each representing a particular sound. It was the simplicity of this alphabet, as much as their commercial prowess, that opened up trade in the ancient Mediterranean. Inland from the port of Sfax are dried desert lake beds where salt can be scraped up in the dry season. This technique, the same as was used 8,000 years ago on Lake Yuncheng in China, and referred to as dragging and gathering, was the original Egyptian way of salt gathering, the method used for harvesting natron in the Wadi of Netrun. The Arabs called such a salt works a sebka, and on a modern map of North Africa, from the Egyptian-Libyan border to the Algerian-Moroccan line, from Sabkat Shunain to Sebka de Tindouf, sebkas are still clearly labeled. In ancient times, the Fezzan region today in southern Libya had contact with Egypt and the Mediterranean. Herodotus wrote of the use of horses and chariots for warfare in Fezzan, which was unusual at the time. Even more unusual, horses also may have been used to transport salt. By the 3rd century BC, Fezzan was noted for its salt production. Fezzan producers had moved beyond simply scraping the sebkas. The crust was boiled until fairly pure crystals had been separated, and they were then molded into 3-foot-high white tapered cylinders. Traders then carried these oddly phallic objects, carefully wrapped in straw mats, by caravan across the desert. Salt is still made and transported the same way today in parts of the Sahara. Because a profitable salt shipment is bulky and heavy, accessible transportation has always been the essential ingredient in salt trade. In most of Asia, Europe, and the Americas, waterways have been the solution. Salt was traded either through seagoing ports or, as in Sichuan, by a sprawling river system. But in the African continent, where a wealth of salt was located in the wadis and dry lake beds of the waterless Sahara, another solution was found. The camel. The earliest known journeys across the Sahara in about 1000 BC were by oxen, and then by horse-drawn chariots. Trans-Saharan commerce existed in ancient times, but crossings were rare events until the 3rd century AD, when the camel replaced the horse. The camel was a native of North America, though it became extinct there 2 million years ago. Around 3000 BC, relatively late in the history of animal domestication, camels were domesticated in the Middle East. The wild species has vanished. Between the domestication of the camel and its use in the Sahara, several millennia passed. But once the domestic camel made its Sahara debut, its use spread quickly. By the Middle Ages, caravans of 40,000 camels carried salt from Dauden'i to Timbuktu, a 435-mile journey taking as long as 1 month. Since then, continuing to this day, caravans of camels have moved bulk goods across the Sahara to Western and Central Africa. As the trade prospered, so did banditry, and the caravans grew in size for protection. As salt moved south, gold, kola nut, leather, and cotton from Hausa land in present-day Nigeria was traded north. Later, products for Europe, including acacia gum, which was needed for fabric sizing, and Melegueta pepper, the seeds of an orange West African fruit that were a Renaissance European food craze, were also brought north. Slaves, too, were taken on this route, and even at times traded for salt. In 1352, Ibn Battuta, the greatest Arab-language traveler of the Middle Ages, who had journeyed overland across Africa, Europe, and Asia, reported visiting the city of Taghaza, which, he said, was entirely built of salt, including an elaborate mosque. By the time Europeans first discovered it in the 19th century, the fabled Western Saharan city of salt had been abandoned. Taghaza was not the earliest report of buildings made of salt. The 1st century AD Roman, Pliny the Elder, writing of rock salt mining in Egypt, mentioned houses built of salt. Taghaza is imagined as a sparkling white city, but it was swept by Saharan sands, and the pockmarked salt turned a dingy gray. Though its salt construction impressed later travelers, salt blocks were the only material available for building, and Taghaza was probably a miserable work camp, inhabited mostly by the slaves forced to work it, who completely depended on the arrival of caravans to bring them food. In ancient Taghaza, salt was quarried from the near surface in 200-pound blocks loaded on camels, one block on each side. The powerful animals carried them 500 miles to Timbuktu, a trading center because of its location on the northernmost crook of the Niger River, which connects most of West Africa. In Timbuktu, the goods of North Africa, the Sahara, and West Africa were exchanged, and the wealth from trade built a cultural center. Timbuktu became a university town, a center of learning. But to the locals in Taghaza, salt was worth nothing except as a building material. They lacked everything but salt. It was said that in the markets to the south of Taghaza, salt was exchanged for its weight in gold, which was an exaggeration. The misconception comes from the West African style of silent barter noted by Herodotus and subsequently by many other Europeans. In the gold-producing regions of West Africa, a pile of gold would be set out, and a salt merchant would counter with a pile of salt, each side altering their piles until an agreement was reached. No words were exchanged during this process, which might take days. The salt merchants often arrived at night to adjust their piles and leave unseen. They were extremely secretive, not wanting to reveal the location of their deposits. From this, it was reported in Europe that salt was exchanged in Africa for its weight in gold. But it is probable that the final agreed-upon two piles were never of equal weight. The fact that in ancient Egypt the poor were mummified with sodium chloride and the rich with natron suggests that the Egyptians valued natron more. But the reverse appears to have been true in other parts of ancient Africa. Generally, the richer Africans used salt with higher sodium chloride content, and natron was the salt of the poor. In West Africa, white natron was used for bean cakes of millet or sorghum, called kunu. The natron in this dish was thought to be beneficial to nursing mothers. Natron was preferred to salt for bean dishes because it was thought that the carbonate counteracted gas. It was also used, and still is, as a stomach medicine, a natural bicarbonate of soda. Natron was believed to be a male aphrodisiac as well. In Timbuktu, which was a center of not only the salt trade but the tobacco trade, a mixture of tobacco and natron was chewed. The Hausa also used natron to dissolve indigo so that the color could be fixed. Soap was made from natron and an oil from the kernel of the shea butter tree. The African salt market has always distinguished between a wide assortment of salts, most of them impure. Salt that was mainly sodium chloride was used exclusively for eating. Sodium chloride, natron, and other salts of varying impurities from different locations were widely known by their own names. African merchants, healers, and cooks were well versed in this array of salts. Trona was the name of a well-known natron valued for food. It was gathered from the shore of Lake Chad. Africans have maintained a tradition of a wide variety of different salts for different dishes, but they always treat any salt as a valuable substance that must not be wasted. R. Omosanlola Williams, a Nigerian educator, published a cookbook for Nigerian housewives in 1957, shortly before Nigerian independence. Among her suggestions for salt, salt is molded in some parts of Nigeria to make it last longer. This has to be scraped and crushed before it is used. The Yorubas use a kind of solid salt called Iyoobu. They tie it in a piece of cloth and squeeze it in water. This is removed when it has seasoned the water sufficiently and is kept and reused. Africans became so accustomed to their impure salts with specific tasks found for each blend that when Europeans in the age of colonialism introduced pure sodium chloride, Africans mixed it with other salts to make salt compounds more to their liking. Chapter 3. Salt Men Hard as Codfish. In 1666, the Salzburg Chronicle described the following incident. In the year 1573, on the 13th of the winter month, a shocking comet star appeared in the sky, and on the 26th of this month, a man, 9 hand spans in length, with flesh, legs, hair, beard, and clothing, in a state of non-decay, although somewhat flattened, the skin a smoky brown color, yellow and hard like codfish, was dug out of the Twerenberg Mountain, 6,300 shoe lengths deep, and was laid out in front of the church for all to see. After a while, however, the body began to rot and was laid to rest. He was found by salt miners in the Dernberg Mountain mine near the Austrian town of Hallein, a name which means salt work, near Salzburg, which means salt town. The perfectly preserved body, dried and salted like codfish, was that of a bearded man with a pickaxe found near him, evidently a miner, wearing pants, a woolen jacket, leather shoes, and a cone-shaped felt hat. The bright colors of the patterned clothing, plaid twill with brilliant red, were striking not only because of how well the salt conserved the colors, but also because Europeans are not thought of as people dressed in such a flaming palette. In 1616, a similar body had been found in nearby Hallstatt, which also means salt town. Inside these alpine mountains of salt, the weight of the rock overhead causes walls to shift, opening cavities and closing up shafts. Water running over the rock salt turns to brine, which then crystallizes, sealing over cracks. Three prehistoric miners have been found, trapped in their dark ancient worksites, and many tools, leather shoes, clothes in their original bright colors, the oldest color-preserved European textiles ever found, leather sacks for hauling rock salt on their backs, torches made of pine sticks bundled together and dipped in resin, and a horn possibly used to warn of cave-ins, all well-preserved in salt. The bodies were dated to 400 BC, but some of the objects found in the remains of a log cabin, thatched roof village on the mountainside may date back to 1300 BC. The colorfully dressed salt miners of Helene were Celts. Celts did not illustrate their culture on temple walls as the Egyptians did, nor did they have chroniclers as the Greeks and Romans did. The guardians of Celtic culture, the Druids, did not leave written records, so most of what we know of them is from Greek and Roman historians who described the Celts as huge and terrifying men in bright fabrics. Aristotle described them as barbarians who went naked in the cold northern weather, abhorred obesity, and were hospitable to strangers. Diodorus, a Greek historian who lived in Sicily, wrote, "They are very tall in stature, with rippling muscles under clear white skin. Their hair is blonde, but not naturally so. They bleach it, to this day artificially washing it in lime and combing it back from their foreheads. They look like wood demons, their hair thick and shaggy like a horse's mane. Some of these are clean-shaven, but others, especially those of high rank, shave their cheeks, but leave a mustache that covers the whole of the mouth, and when they eat and drink, acts like a sieve, trapping particles of food." It is a sad fate for a people to be defined for posterity by their enemies. Even the name Celt is not from their own Indo-European language, but from Greek. Keltoi, the name given to them by Greek historians, among them Herodotus, means one who lives in hiding or undercover. The Romans, finding them less mysterious, called them Galli, or Gauls, also coming from a Greek word used by Egyptians as well, hal, meaning salt. They were the salt people. The name of the town that sits on an East German salt bed, Halle, like the Austrian towns of Hallein, Schwabisch Hall, and Hallstatt, has the same root as do both Galicia in northern Spain and Galicia in southern Poland, where the town of Halych is found. All these places were named for Celtic salt works. Their land was in what is now Hungary, Austria, and Bavaria. The rivers Rhine, Main, Neckar, Ruhr, and Isar are all thought to have been named by the Celts. Like the ancient Chinese emperors, they based their economy on salt and iron, and so needed waterways to transport their heavy goods. The Celts used rivers for trade and conquest. They moved west into France, south into northern Spain, and north into Belgium, named after a Celtic tribe, the Belgae. At the time that the mineshaft trapped the miner in Dernburg, Celts were moving into the British Isles and the Mediterranean. In 390 BC, the Celts sacked Rome, having traveled 80 miles in 4 days on horseback, in an age when Western Europeans had not seen mounted cavalry. They terrorized townspeople with their heavy swords and loud war cries. The Celts controlled Rome for the next 40 years, and in 279 BC they invaded what is now Turkey. Exactly how far in the world they traveled, settled, and traded is not certain. Until the 19th century, Western history generally dismissed the Celts as crude and frightening barbarians. But in 1846, a mining engineer named Johann Georg Ramsauer began looking for pyrite deposits in the area of the Hallstatt salt mine near Hallein. Instead, he found two skeletons, an axe, and a piece of bronze jewelry. Then he discovered 7 more bodies buried with valuables. He reported his findings to the government in Vienna and received funding from the curator of the imperial coin collection to continue digging. In one summer, he found another 58 graves. In 16 years, he found 1,000 graves, both burials and cremation urns, and carefully catalogued thousands of objects. Numbering each grave, an artist made a watercolor record of the bodies and artifacts at each site. Ramsauer's meticulous scientific methodology made him a pioneer in the new science of archaeology. In the process, a great deal was learned about the early salt-trading Celts. The Hallstatt period became the archaeological name for a rich early Iron Age culture, beginning about 700 BC and lasting until 450 BC. Ramsauer's Hallstatt graves were mostly from 700 to 600 BC, with some as late as 500 BC. The Dernburg discoveries from 400 BC suggest that the Hallstatt mine began to diminish in importance as the Dernburg one became a more important source of salt. Ramsauer's dig and the Dernburg finds showed a society living off of salt mining, secluded on remote and rugged mountains at an altitude of 3,000 feet, and yet trading to the far ends of the continent. These people were buried with valuable possessions from the Mediterranean, from North Africa, even from the Near East. Ramsauer's investigation of these salt miners began to challenge the perception of Northern Europe's Iron Age barbarians. Only in the 1990s did Westerners become aware of the mummies that had been found in the Uyghur Autonomous Region of China. They had been discovered in and near the Tarim Basin, west of Tibet, east of Samarkand and Tashkent, between China and Central Asia along the Silk Road, the principal trade route between the Mediterranean and Beijing. It was the road of Marco Polo, but these people had lived more than 3 millennia earlier, about 2000 BC. As with the early Egyptian burials that are 1,000 years older, the corpses had been preserved by the naturally salty soil. The condition of the bodies and their bright-colored clothing was spectacular. The men wore leggings striped in blue, ochre, and crimson. They appeared to be tall with blonde or light brown hair, sometimes red beards, and the women's hair woven in long blonde braids. These unknown people were in appearance notably similar to the large, blue-eyed, blonde Celtic warriors described by the Romans almost 2 millennia later. Their conical felt hats and twill jackets bore a close resemblance to those of the salt miners in Hallein and Hallstatt, not unlike the much later plaids of the Scottish Highlands. The red and blue pinstripes were almost identical to fabrics found in the Dernburg mine. Textile historian Elizabeth Wayland Barber concluded that even the weave was nearly identical workmanship. Why Celts might have been in the salty desert of Asia many centuries before there were known to be Celts remains a mystery. In the centuries when the Celtic culture was documented, beginning 1,300 years after these seemingly Celtic bodies were buried in Asian salt, they did trade and travel great distances, usually selling salt from their rich central European mines. Like the Egyptians, they learned that it was not as profitable to trade and transport salt as salted foods. According to the Greeks and Romans, who not only wrote about Celts but traded Mediterranean products for their salt and salt products, Celts ate a great deal of meat, both wild and domesticated. Salted meat was a Celtic specialty. When the Romans finally succeeded in imposing their culture on the Celts, Mocus, which means pig, was the Celtic name for the god Mercury. The Celts did not mean it unkindly. To the pig-loving Celts, the leg of wild boar was considered the choicest piece of meat and was reserved for warriors. With domesticated pigs also, according to Strabo, the 1st century BC Greek historian, the Celts preferred the legs. It is likely that among the Celtic contributions to Western culture are the first salt-cured hams. Athenaeus, a 1st century AD Greek living in Rome, wrote that the Celts most valued the upper part of the ham, which was reserved for the bravest warrior. If two warriors claimed rights to this cut, the dispute would be settled by combat. Fighting over the ham may be more the Greco-Roman view of Celts than the reality, but the Celts certainly made, traded, and ate hams. Among the few remaining Celtic cultures, this tradition of savoring a salt-cured leg from the hunt endures. An example is Scottish salted haunch of venison. Take the venison to be salted after it has hung in the larder for 2 days. Cut it into pieces the required size. See that it is clean and free from fly, but on no account wash it with water. Take 2 pounds kitchen salt, 1/4 pound demerara sugar, 1 teaspoon black pepper, 1/2 teaspoon natron. Mix these well together. Rub pieces of venison on every side with this mixture for 2 to 3 days in succession. Then place them in a wooden tub or earthenware jar and press them well together. After 10 days, the venison is ready for use. Venison treated in this way, if pressed into a jar and the air excluded, should keep for months, and a haunch, which has been well salted in this manner for about 3 weeks, can be hung up to dry as a ham. Margaret Fraser, A Highland Cookery Book, 1930. According to Annette Hope, an Edinburgh librarian who collected Scottish recipes, Margaret Fraser came from a family of gamekeepers on a Highland estate, and most of her recipes were for venison, though the same ideas may have been used for legs of other game and domestic meat. The sugar. She specified the light brown of Demerara, British Guiana, would not have been used by original Celts, but the natron may have been. The early Celtic salt miners understood their mountains. They realized that horizontal shafts from the mountainside, though a great deal easier to travel and move rock through, would require far more digging to reach the rich salt deposits. Instead, they dug at steep angles and skillfully shored up the shafts. The miners had to climb out, flaming torch clenched in their teeth, leather back sack loaded with rock at 45 or 50 degree angles. Though the master ironworkers of their age, they made their picks and other metal tools out of bronze, the antiquated metal of a more primitive era. They seem to have learned that bronze would not be corroded by salt the way iron is. The Celts, or their Central European ancestors, known as the Urnfield people, because they cremated their dead and buried them in urns, had many innovations besides those in salt mining. They developed the first organized agriculture in Northern Europe, experimenting with such revolutionary ideas as fertilizer and crop rotation. They introduced wheat to Northern Spain. They were sophisticated bronze casters, skilled iron miners and forgers. They introduced to much of Western Europe iron and their many iron inventions, including chain armor and the feared Celtic sword, which was 3 feet long. But they also invented the seamless iron rim for wagon wheels, the barrel, and possibly the horseshoe. They may have been the first Europeans to ride horses. One thing the Celts were not advanced in was statecraft. Ironically, the closest the Celts ever came to fusing into a nation was in the 1st century when Julius Caesar conquered Gaul. A Celtic leader named Vercingetorix, which means warrior king, gathered warriors from the diverse Celtic groups to face the Romans at Alesia, now Alise-Saint-Reine, on the Lower Seine. Vercingetorix's father had attempted the same thing unsuccessfully in 80 BC. According to Caesar, while besieged, Celts were so desperate that they were debating whether to eat the elderly non-combatants, 41 Celtic tribes responded to Vercingetorix's call by sending a relief column to Alesia of 8,000 horsemen and 250,000 foot soldiers. Some historians believe that had the Celts won at Alesia, it would have been the beginning of a united Celtic nation. But the Romans won and subjugated the Celts and wrote their history. Despite the fame of their bright clothing, Celts are described going naked into battle, except for horned helmets. We are told that they had frightening war cries and that the terrifying songs of their ancestors were preludes to violent attacks. They fought, the Romans said, with a furor, and they swooped off heads with their large iron swords and hung these trophies on their houses or strung them along the horse bridle. Vercingetorix was apparently a ruthless leader, a fanatic obsessed with freeing his people from the Romans, willing to destroy entire towns and ruthlessly level opponents to achieve his goal. But he was trying to stand up to the Roman legions of Julius Caesar. The Roman historian Plutarch estimated that the civilized Romans under Julius Caesar, in his decade-long campaign in Gaul, destroyed 800 towns and villages and enslaved 3 million people. After the Roman campaigns were over, all that remained of Celtic life were isolated groups on the far Atlantic coasts. Northwestern Iberia, the Brittany Peninsula, the Cornish tip of England, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, and the Isle of Man. All of these groups were treated by the chroniclers of later nation-states as recalcitrant people interfering with the building of great states, Britain, France, or Spain. The Roman victory had been total. Celtic inventions in salt mining, iron, agriculture, trade, horsemanship, enriched the Roman Empire. Celtic salt mines became part of Roman wealth, and Celtic hams became part of the Roman diet, with few ever remembering that such things were once Celtic. The Celts were innovators. The Romans were nation builders. Chapter 4. Salt's Salad Days. The Romans paid homage to democracy, the rights of the common citizen, and for a time, republicanism. But they rarely lived up to any of these ideals. Roman history is the chronic struggle between the privileged patricians and the disenfranchised plebeians. Plebeians fought to have a voice, and patricians endeavored to keep them excluded. The Roman patrician often tried to keep his privileges by offering lesser rights to plebeians. In this spirit, patricians insisted that every man had a right to salt. Common salt, as it has come to be known, was a Roman concept. Patricians ate an elaborate cuisine that expressed opulence in ingredients and presentation. Roman cooks seemed to avoid leaving anything in its natural state. They loved the esoteric, such as sow's vulva and teats, a dish that is frequently mentioned for banquets and which provoked a debate as to whether it should be from a virgin sow or, as Pliny the Elder suggested, one whose first litter was aborted. Sometimes the cuisine emphasized local pride. The best pike had to be caught in the Tiber between the city bridges of Rome. But food was also a way to boast of conquest, with hams from Germania, oysters from Britannia, and sturgeon from the Black Sea. Meanwhile, plebeians ate coarse bread, cereals, a little salt fish, and olives. And the government made certain they had salt. Roman government did not maintain a monopoly on salt sales, as did the Chinese, but it did not hesitate to control salt prices when it seemed necessary. The earliest record of Roman government interference in salt prices was in 506 BC, only 3 years before the kingdom was declared a republic. The state took over Rome's premier source of salt, the private salt works in Ostia, because the king regarded its prices as too high. Both under the Republic and later the Empire, Roman government periodically subsidized the price of salt to ensure that it was easily affordable for plebeians. It was a gift, like a tax cut, that government could bestow when in need of popular support. On the eve of Emperor Augustus's decisive naval campaign defeating Mark Antony and Cleopatra, Augustus garnered public support by distributing free olive oil and salt. But during the Punic Wars, 264 to 146 BC, a century-long struggle to the death for control of the Mediterranean with the Phoenician colony of Carthage, Rome manipulated salt prices to raise money for the war. In the fashion of the Chinese emperors, the Roman government declared an artificially high price for salt and put the profits at the disposal of the military. A low price was still maintained in the city of Rome, but elsewhere a charge was added in accordance with the distance from the nearest salt work. This salt tax system was devised by Marcus Livius, a tribune, a government official representing plebeians. Because of his salt price scheme, he became known as the Salinator, which later became the title of the official in the treasury who was responsible for decisions about salt prices. Most Italian cities were founded proximate to salt works, starting with Rome in the hills behind the salt works at the mouth of the Tiber. Those salt works along the northern bank were controlled by Etruscans. In 640 BC, the Romans, not wanting to be dependent on Etruscan salt, founded their own salt works across the river in Ostia. They built a single shallow pond to hold seawater until the sun evaporated it into salt crystals. The first of the great Roman roads, the Via Salaria, Salt Road, was built to bring this salt not only to Rome, but across the interior of the peninsula. This worked well in the Roman part of the Italian peninsula, but as Rome expanded, transporting salt longer distances by road became too costly. Not only did Rome want salt to be affordable for the people, but more importantly, as the Romans became ambitious empire builders, they needed it to be available for the army. The Roman army required salt for its soldiers and for its horses and livestock. At times, soldiers were even paid in salt, which was the origin of the word salary, and the expression worth his salt, or earning his salt. In fact, the Latin word sal became the French word solde, meaning pay, which is the origin of the word soldier. To the Romans, salt was a necessary part of empire building. They developed salt works throughout their expanded world, establishing them on seashores, marshes, and brine springs throughout the Italian peninsula. By conquest, they took over not only Hallstatt, Hallein, and the many Celtic works of Gaul and Britain, but also the salt works of the Phoenicians and Carthaginians in North Africa, Sicily, Spain, and Portugal. They acquired Greek works and Black Sea works and ancient Middle Eastern works, including the salt works of Mount Sodom by the Dead Sea. More than 60 salt works from the Roman Empire have been identified. Romans boiled sea salt in pottery, which they broke after a solid salt block had formed inside. Piles of pottery shards mark many ancient Roman sea salt sites throughout the Mediterranean. The Romans also pumped seawater into single ponds for solar evaporation, as in Ostia. They mined rock salt, scraped dry lake beds like African sebkas, boiled the brine from marshes, and burned marsh plants to extract salt from the ashes. None of these techniques were Roman inventions. Aristotle had mentioned brine spring evaporation in the 4th century B.C., Hippocrates, the 5th century BC physician, seems to have known about solar evaporated sea salt. He wrote, "The sun attracts the finest and lightest part of the water and carries it high up. The saltiness remains because of its thickness and weight, and in this way the salt originates." The Roman genius was administration, not the originality of the project, but the scale of the operation. The Romans salted their greens.